Good evening, people of the Bone Club. We're coming to you live from Baltimore and the American Academy of Forensic Science Conference. I'm here with you with Stephanie.
Hey, everyone.
And a whole bunch of friends we've gathered.
Hello.
Yes.
Y'all want to go ahead and introduce yourselves?
Sure, I can start. Hi, my name is Taylor Flaherty. I am a doctoral candidate at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I specialize specifically in biocultural forensic anthropology.
I'm Thomas Delgado. I'm a, wow, who am I? I am a doctoral student at the University of Utah. I focus on the isotopic analysis of human tissues and structural vulnerability of marginalized populations.
Hello, I am Khalil Mahou. I am a teacher here as in the lecture of forensic anthropology in the American University of Science and Technology. My thesis is about human bone remains.
My name is Skylar. I am currently a PhD student at Leiden University in the Netherlands. My PhD topic covers the missing and deceased migration crisis in the Mediterranean, and specifically how the lack of state accountability impacts the search process.
Hi, my name is Hannah Carson. I'm a PhD student at the University of Montana. My current research focuses more on combining skeletal and molecular techniques on ancient brains, but my background is mostly in forensic anthropology, so that's my passion. So, yeah.
I guess that's me. I'm Sam Blatt. I'm an associate professor at Idaho State University, and I dabble in forensics and bioarchaeology and forensic world. I do novel identification and biocultural practices, but I also love teeth and really old bones, and so I travel around doing that whenever I can also.
You can keep the teeth.
Maybe the teeth. No, I'm totally cool. You have that teeth, you don't want to deal with them. I am your girl.
But yeah. Also, if you have third molars, I'll take it.
Yeah, yeah, we'll work.
Yeah, we'll work. I'll be in Idaho soon.
Yeah.
I figured a very easy way to start off this kind of conversation about AFS and kind of what's going on at the conference is to talk about the location. As Ashley said, we're in Baltimore. How'd everyone feel about Baltimore this week? I know for myself, coming from Hawaii, I was frozen. So
I am so cold.
I mean, I'll say that coming from Idaho, it's still very cold. There's wind tunnels everywhere.
Yeah,
so
the wind, pretty
it's
intense.
Freezing.
And we didn't even get the snow we were promised.
Yeah, no.
So that's.
I thought a
we got
fun.
Flakes.
Yesterday.
Oh, yeah, I got some flakes.
Yeah,
it
not
just
good
didn't
enough. I'm in Salt Lake. I want snow.
I mean, it's since I've been here on Saturday, it snowed like, I think at least close to 2 feet in Montana since I've been here.
Yeah.
So I'm not missing that.
Yeah. Well, I know the big thing about this year's AFS was that, you know, every year there's a theme that kind of helps focus what research gets presented. And this year's theme was about technology and AI. And I know there were a lot of really good presentations on all of that. There was definitely some people here within this podcast that have even presented on it. So if any of y'all want to like briefly talk about what you thought about the topic and yeah, whatever.
You know what? Yeah, we'll talk about AI. So yeah, this year's theme was something something technology, a tool for something, or tyranny.
Or tyranny. Or
tyranny.
Yeah.
Tyranny.
Like there's a
something or tyranny.
Your tyranny.
Tools.
Yeah.
Tools or tyranny.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the theme was technology and how do we interact with technology in our relationships and lives.
For transformation,
transformation.
We only remember the tyranny. That's the important part of this discussion.
I love transformer neural networks. They're very cool. So the theme I thought was very interesting and particularly relevant. You know, forensic anthropologists have been integrating artificial intelligence technologies into their research for the better part of a decade. But we haven't yet started really critically examining our relationship with these techniques, the ethics, the bioethics, and the politics that come alongside of them, and also understanding them at a higher than anthropology, but still semi-rudimentary computer science level. so we can make these really critical decisions. We're actually utilizing them and presenting novel research with them. So I love the theme. Myself and Taylor Flaherty both organized a symposium that centered around how we use artificial intelligence and forensic anthropology, focusing specifically on methodological applications. So this is how we do the work. This is clear steps to how we did it. And how can we make this reproducible, accessible, and fair across the wider, you know, wider field?
Yeah, and I think Ashley said something really good earlier. You said something really good about the symposium. If you wanted to repeat it, then you got it.
Well, it depends on what the thing was, because I've said a lot about the symposium. I thought it was very important. I think it is the direction of where forensic anthropology is going. I think it's the direction of where forensic science as a overarching field is going. But I do have reservations and questions. I asked Thomas this yesterday during the symposium, and I'll pose it to you again for everybody who's listening. And I want everybody to jump in on this if they can. When we look at what we've done, I'll couch it this way. Several years ago, I wrote a paper on standardization in osteometrics. And I noted that in a list of osteometric measurements, our field, our study couldn't hit 80% on any one. It was all 80% or not even 80% or below. I mean, it was just, we couldn't hit that 80% threshold. Those are then replicated in databases like Fortis. You have that same replication in any sort of measurements out there. If you have that error, either in databases or in user input within AI, do you think AI would replicate that error in the future or magnify it? Or can it serve as a corrective function and say, hey, wait a second, this just seems like it might be off. You need to fix this.
I mean, that was something that really sparked the discussion for planning the symposium. You know, I came to Thomas as a friend and a colleague who knows a lot about AI and computers, and I said, have some thoughts. I have some questions.
You have a lot of thoughts.
And the biggest thing is that we have to remember that the bias that we have in ourselves and in our samples then gets put into these algorithms, right?
Yeah.
And so I do think that we have to be cautious about what data we apply, what populations we apply data to, and things like that, so that we cannot have our biases reflected in these computer methods, right? At the same time, it comes with its own ethics that we have to consider. And so that's fine too. Lots of opinions yesterday, yeah. I think, on questions similar to yours on, Ashley, on why or how we most ethically implement these tools. And I do think there's a risk, and I do think we need to go forth and see how we can best remove our bias as much as possible from our data collection and from our methods that we're building.
But can we remove our biases? Can even using an algorithm, even using machine learning and neural networks and things like that, can we ultimately, at the end result, remove our biases?
You know, I will say, I would correct myself. Yeah, I don't think we can remove it fully. I don't think we can. I think even things like if you've ever seen the very basic example of Googling different types of professional attire for different like cultural groups of people, the bias is so built into that, where if you look at like professional hair for Black women, their natural hair very infrequently shows up in a Google Images search. And so we are seeing our biases reflected in these. And so I guess you're absolutely correct. I wouldn't say we remove it. We have to see how we can accommodate it and how we can challenge it.
And I think that also just like comes down to, can the field even agree on what's an okay bias?
Mm-hmm.
Because like bias isn't necessarily inherently negative, but as a field, we tend to not even agree on what's okay. Like what types of maybe sample bias is good for, you know, a certain study, or what is actually negatively affecting how we're implementing this in a broader spectrum. And there doesn't seem to be consensus. So I think that before, I know for myself going into this, like this conference, I was cautiously optimistic, I guess, because in my job, don't really use the technology in that same way. I feel like we're a little stuck in a little bit older school just because of, you know, who we're working with and what populations we're trying to identify. And so the methods somewhat work, and so they're kind of not changing it too much. And so I was just like, how, if we can't even agree as a field, what's okay as far as what's standard and what's willing, like what we're willing to have in our science, how are we going to progress forward with technologies and AIs and other things like that? We can't even agree on how to do an age assessment by itself using the methods that we have already. Okay. So,
And then I guess for me, just to go back, because I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I do want to address your first question as well with it, Ashley. Just to reiterate what I said in the symposium, I think that we have to take a critical look at how we interact with data and how we interact with this observer error that we see throughout our measurements. AI will not correctively look for that. I guess I shouldn't say that. Could you code it? Could you develop a tool that does it? Yes. Do I think it would be really useful and applicable to what we do? No, because we need to be correcting that error on the back end instead of just saying there is error here.
Yeah.
And I think I saw a lot of really good posters and presentations these last couple of days about measuring inter and intra observer error and how we approach most of our biological assessment techniques. So I think right now we're having some of these really critical conversations. AI is not going to be able to learn to fix our problems for us. That has to be fixed in the data and how we handle the data.
I don't think we should imagine that it could do that either.
I agree.
Then we're the critical thinkers. We need to maintain that level as well. We shouldn't put things in the black box and expect, oh, now this is correct. Like the validation of AI is needs to continue.
Yes. And on a selfish level, I'm not trying to work myself out of a job.
No.
Well, I think that's the big takeaway yesterday, right?
Yeah.
Multiple presenters said AI is not here to take our jobs. It's
not at the level of we have to be concerned about fixing our own error via these methods.
But to be a contrarian, and I believe, Skylar, you were at the talk today. I believe you were there.
Oh.
There was a talk this afternoon about using programs, AI programs such as ChatGPT and Grok 3, where you can enter into the program a three-dimensional photograph, a three-dimensional image, and ask it to do a, in this case, a sex and age assessment. And could it give you an accurate result with reasonings behind it? And their result was yes, only they used two images. I have a severe problem with an N of two.
Yeah.
But
and then
that
like,
seems to be just me. But I also have a problem with the simplicity of just that.
Yes. And I think that got really well addressed by Dr. Carolyn Isaacs, who was a presenter at our symposium. She's a professor at Michigan State University. And I think she did a really good job at showing that actually, no. It's like we can feed it all ChatGPT, these large language models, these chest radiographs, antemortem, postmortem comparison, and say, can you do it? And it might do it. Quotes.
Yeah.
But if you ask for real technical reasoning, it does not and cannot provide that. And I think a large part of that is because we do lack some standardized language. If we trained an LLM on a set of standardized definitions that it could then regurgitate at us, then yes, I think it could then do that or simulate it. But I don't think we're at the point, and I think Dr. Isaacs definitely showed this as well, where large language models and their raw base form could come close to approximating practitioner vocabulary.
Could it incorporate all enough peering into the future? And I know us peering into the future is Bleak. Yes, it'll. Well, it's also. It's also anything and everything that happens. Yeah. Yeah, it's just anything and everything can happen in the future. But when you look at things like what Dr. Isaacs was saying, I look at chest x-rays, I look at chest CTs. And yes, you can do identifications and have our standards standardized, though we don't have the right language on how to do identifications. And you could do a language model, large language model, on trying to do those identifications. But one of the reasons why we see those CTs in the first place, we see those x-rays in the first place, is because of pathologies. Pathologies do not lend themselves to a standardization. They've never lend themselves to a standardization. Can a large language model, can machine learning or any other sort of AI algorithm pick up on the non-standardization and the irregularities of pathologies and use them for identification?
Well, now we're getting into the standardization of and the lack of standardization of biomedical terminology, which is a whole other rabbit hole.
And I can definitely talk. Yeah, you actually probably could. Maybe not with large language models, but with convolutional neural networks or transfer learning, which we also saw usage of those in our symposium yesterday. Yeah, you probably could. But I think there's a huge caveat here. It would have to be only caring about traditionally expressed forms of a pathology. I think that there's some level of pathological variability. I mean, diffuse idiosyncratic chronic hyperostosis. Whatever. I mean, that is the most wild
dish
thing.
That dish. It looks like a candlestick, so there we'll call it
exactly. So as that fuses, it can take on such varying forms of complexity. And then if you're only getting like this much of the vertebral column, okay, is it dish or is it just some really bad osteoarthritic clipping? So I think it could do something, but I don't think it's going to be able to account for those varied pathologies, which I actually think are more common than the textbook ones.
Well, I think that kind of just goes back to, which will be the, you know, the top of next year's
back to basics
of what anthropology is, and it's right, is looking at the looking at the vast variability of human existence and trying to categorize it to a certain extent to where we can try to use it in a cultural setting. You can get something from a computer that'll help you maybe guide where you're going with it, but at the end of the day, it's still going to have to be a human on the other end looking at what getting outputs and then saying, does that make sense to begin with? And then how do we use that in our practice? I mean, I know I use ChatGPT to create my grocery list and stuff because I'm lazy and I don't know how to cook. But at the end of the day, I might have to look at it and be like, you know, maybe I'm not feeling Mexican food tonight and I want something else. Like, you know, that's a very simplified version of what I'm talking about, but
I think that is the answer,
but you have to still have that human aspect to it.
I think that's essential. I definitely don't think we're ever going to be in an environment where there's not a human on the other side. I personally, 50 years down the road, this could be completely wrong. I really don't think it's that level.
Yeah, but that by that time, I'll be retired.
So. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and again, this is the same thing that the original AI founder said in 1943. But it stagnated for 20 years, nothing happened, and then we have more powerful computers. So it might be 100 years, it might be a little bit. Is it theoretically possible? Yes, because it's just the replication of neurons. Theoretically, it shouldn't be too challenging, but I don't think you can teach a machine to logic.
Yeah.
I think the contextual information, unless you can feed all those variables, then at that case, you literally are mirroring cognition, and we're not. I don't know if that's possible.
Watson's not there yet.
Not yet, but maybe.
I do have a question. Change it a little bit. And for me, for my research, I've had to switch using ImageJ to a different software package because my images were just so large, ImageJ just can't. when you're looking at sort of these large, these machine learning programs, neural network programs, and things like that, when you're dealing with computational images, 3D is obviously better than 2D. The greater the point cloud, the better the image, the better the outcome. But is there a plateau at which, you know, beyond this point, it's just you're getting nothing better from it and just crashing the system or just not receiving what you need out of it?
To give a literal answer, yes. I'm sorry, I'm talking the most about this. I don't want to turn on to it. But the literal answer is yes, there is a point. There is such a thing as data saliency. When you hit a point where more data do not necessarily result in better performance. I would say for forensic anthropological sample size, we don't reach that level of saliency. But when we're talking like raw resolution, yes, especially when it comes to human perception. We can only perceive a lot. We can actually replicate a lot more pixels than we can perceive and a lot more colors than we can perceive through our technology. But we do it because it's fun, I guess. But yeah, you can hit a point of data saliency in basically any aspect of technological computation.
No, I think with even just with data sets, trying to get the number of individuals into the system, I don't think we're ever going to hit a point where we can hit that because we just don't have the bodies. When we won't have the bodies.
I think the only way that we could get close to that point is if we start routinely collecting medical data from living patients. I think we could get enough patients at some very far point in the future that we could have a big enough data set to have to worry about that. But
we could get living CT data. The problem is that I see is ethics related to getting living CT data or even to see CT data. Because particularly with living individuals, they may consent to their data being used for Project X. What about Y, Z, A, B? At what point do we say here we want to take your use your CT and use it for research infinitum? And is that ethical to even ask?
That almost goes back to our next year's theme of back to basics.
Yeah.
Because where we're just collecting data and then nobody knows about it and they don't again have their consent that they can give generations later. And this is where we started in anthropology.
Yeah.
And are we just doing it again in just a different way? So there are are very valid reasons why people do not want any of their information out and on many different levels, not beyond medical. They're very thing, from history too.
Yep.
And so that hasn't been established how that should work. Nobody agrees yet how that should work. So I think we need to take that memory that we're sitting with now to trying to understand how to build something that's large enough for us to work with. And I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is like, I feel like a good portion of our field believes this. I wouldn't say all, but having to keep in mind that yes, while this might be data or this might be a collection that we're trying to learn from, and we're trying to do our best to progress science in a way that's better for the future, it's still people that we're working on, and they had lived experiences and lives and families that cared about them. And like, you have to always not forget that aspect when doing any research moving forward.
Even a practical measure is like, there's so many variables on how everybody's so different. I would at some point you'd be like, I don't know the variables, so I can't even use this. And then you collect it and stored things just like today in museums, and you don't know what to do.
On the top of this, let's say an additional complexity on this topic is that we are supposed to collect the data and collect the whole in from consent and so on. But in case there is a data breach,
yeah,
You know, it's all information.
Yeah.
To whom it's going to be sent, to whom it's going to be sell in the dark market, and so on and so on. How to secure the second level? That's going to be, from my side, that's the complication. Because we are collecting, collecting, collecting. And even though we have the old bioethics behind us, but collecting where? Is that much secure? Or maybe someone uses for different purposes that we still are not aware of, you know, on the point.
Well, the problem I have in shooting myself in the foot, knowing I'm shooting myself in the foot, is the NMDIB, the New Mexico, the Seed and Identification Database. And I remember sitting there, I was a moderator in a session, and a few years ago, and they were announcing a presentation, the database. And someone asked if the decedents had given their authorization to be used for research. And the response was, in the state of New Mexico, it's publicly admissible data because it's all medical examiner records are public data. So it's out there. And I have had at the time and still have a real ethical qualm about that database because these people did not give consent for their CT data, for their autopsy data to be used for research. And a lot of them are, yes, Native American individuals, they're indigenous individuals who our field has historically not been the nicest to.
And this is where like ethics and like legal frameworks don't necessarily line up because there is a massive objectification of deceased individuals where people just forget that the body used to be a human being.
Yep.
It's like a skeleton and not just like a bunch of random objects in the ground. It's like that was a person. That is a person. That person has a family. It doesn't matter, you know, like if it's legally, you know, allowed. We should be thinking more deeply into those ethical ramifications of what that person and the data around that person, those that can impact people who are still living in very big ways.
Yeah, I know I saw this on like Facebook or something, so like that dates my age, but it was something that essentially said, just because it's legal doesn't mean that it's right. And that really, like you had your talk that like, you had said there's no rights for the dead. Really, like, you know, it hit home because I was like, yeah, this is like the legal applicability, which is like what forensic science is supposed to be. You know, it's anthropology to a legal question. It's like, well, is the legal question really all that we should be worried about? And what are we looking at as a whole, not just for the purpose of answering that legal question?
I have used NMDID a bit. I don't know what my full answers are to all of these thoughts. Because I've heard Ashley specifically express these concerns before. And it's really hard because on one hand,
we do get valuable information.
Yes.
Yeah.
We do get valuable information that can actually stand a chance at representing our actual populations, which we have never done in anthropology tests. We have never accurately represented our populations and applied methods accurately to marginalized populations. We have never done that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there are all of these ethical questions. Who, how far past the date of your death do you get consent over your body? When do you stop having autonomy? And I think this is a broader question for biological anthropology. Sorry to burst the bubble, but like we do the same thing with archaeological remains.
Yeah.
You know, we don't contact descendant communities and get consent from the descendants to excavate their potential loved ones. We see a burial on the ground and we excavate it and we store it somewhere, most often in a lab that very infrequently gets repatriated to who it belongs to.
Yep.
So Do we bring into question our entire field?
I think we do. But that is the purpose of being an anthropologist, and that is the purpose of being young anthropologists, is we always have to not only honor and respect what those that have gone before have done, but we have to challenge and find better ways of doing.
Well, and that's kind of why I know, like, don't get me wrong, I love listening to everyone's talks to the anthropology section, but because I know most of y'all, I'm like, oh, I'll get your research later. I like to go to the other section talks.
Yes.
Because most other sections within the American Academy of Forensic Sciences are not humanitarian workers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are service members, like, they, you know, give service to a community in some regard, but not necessarily from a humanitarian background. And with all the cultural adaptations that are necessary in order to do it properly for any given population. And so I like to go and just see, like, okay, what can I potentially bring? Or not just me, because, like, I'm no one, but, like, what can this question bring to the forefront of other fields within forensic sciences to try to help the whole of forensic science think more humanitarian, think more human, because we're answering these legal questions, but about people. And I think more than just anthropology needs that. And that's why I know when Ashley asked me to do this podcast to begin with, I was like, yes, because I want more people to not just talk to anthropologists about anthropology, because we can go round and round in circles about the ethics of anthropology, and I think we should, but it has to be more than just us. And so that's why I like coming to conferences like this, to go to those other talks and really see, okay, what do the other fields care about, and what are they doing research on, and in what ways?
Toxicologists who spend all day looking at drugs but never see the human side of things.
Right.
And coming from Massachusetts, we had two chemists, Annie Dukin and Sarah Farrakh, who did not see the human side of things and ended up, at the end of the day, vacating close to 60,000 drug convictions.
Well, that's why, like, it was last year, maybe the year before, I'm not 100% sure, my memory's rough. But you're talking about just like, what is objectivity in science? And it's like, yes, you're trying to be as objective as possible in order to make good science. And I think that'll probably be something that we talk about next year for back to basics. But people aren't objective, and people are the ones doing science. And so, like, trying to just get other fields to just, you know, slap them across the face a little bit, to be like, you're the one doing it, you're the one doing the science, you're not objective. Think through what you're doing, please.
I try to drive that point home so frequently. I did a poster presentation yesterday on part of my dissertation, and I am talking about biocultural approaches to forensics all the time, because I fully recognize that we cannot be completely objective, and that we have to recognize our biases so we can understand how to challenge them. I had a poster yesterday, and someone said, well, what is the key takeaway? And I said, the key takeaway is that we have to look at these deceased individuals as a whole person. We can't just do biology. We can't just do culture. We can't just do toxicology. We have to use our whole anthropology brains to do what we need to do. And I think, reminded me.
You're more than just the sum of your parts. You're more than just your biology. You're more than just your culture. You know, like, you are all of those things all at the same time. That doesn't change when you die.
And they play roles together. You know, what I'm constantly screaming at the top of my lungs to whoever will read my papers is that biology and culture interact, and you can embody your culture, and your biology can affect your culture, and vice versa. And so we really have to critically examine how those things interact with each other to best represent individuals, to identify them, obviously, first line of priority is to identify and repatriate, and also to build better, stronger databases that can be used for research.
And I think it's also not just on the decedent. Even though our job is to not worry about who did what to who, we focus on this scene, we also have to keep in mind what the end result of our analyses and our work is. with that forum that we held earlier in the week, that was the purpose of it, having individuals from the Innocence Project, showing that forensic science has this incredible power to wrongfully convict if misused. And when you convict someone, you upend not just a life, you upend lives and communities. And we have to recognize that.
We were recently talking about this earlier today. And something that I often, that I've thought about in the recent years that I try to challenge people to think about too, is why forensic anthropologists who do casework, right, who try to help in the forensic system actively, are only ever considered to be experts for the prosecution. It's very infrequent that defense attorneys are able to get access to us because we typically work in medical examiner's offices and state and federal institutions. And so we have to think to ourselves, is our science going to put someone into the system that is so, so cool? And how do we challenge these cases where there has been junk science used, where there has been an inaccurate application of the methods? How could we start integrating ourselves into that approach to make sure that people are not getting incarcerated, particularly when they are not guilty of what they are being charged with? And going through a trial alone is a huge impact on someone's life. You know, even if they're not convicted, going through the system, the financial and social and mental drain it can put on someone is really, really huge.
Not even the trial, just the mere indictment, even before you get to the indictment phase, can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, and then on, I mean, I don't know who's applied for a job recently, but it doesn't say were you convicted of a crime. It says were you charged with one.
Yeah.
And science, like, that's even before the science happens, really, you know,
yeah,
to a certain extent. But I say, not to necessarily, like, change up the topic, but to let other people talk. I know I talk a lot, too. I figured we can go through and, like, maybe everyone tell, say, like, what your favorite part of the conference is. Kind of bring it back to ask, like, what, or the Academy, sorry. Like, what were maybe favorite talk, maybe favorite presentation, or just, like, something you felt like you learned a lot from this conference?
I mean, honestly, my favorite presentation still at the end was the speakers that Ashley brought in from the Innocence Project. Because I think, I would have loved that to have been the main plenary session. I would have loved the entire Academy to have heard it instead of however many people are in the room, and have it not be scheduled at the end of the day when everybody is exhausted. Because I do think those voices, particularly from Marvin, the person who was... I said his name right.
Yes, it's Marvin. Okay. It was Marvin.
From Marvin, who was the wrongfully convicted individual, like, more people in our field need to hear the consequences of the science and the trials going wrong, so that they aren't just in a prosecutorial only mindset, which, while we maybe are not, too many people in forensics are. So thank you, Ashley.
You're welcome. Hannah, what about you? What was your favorite?
I really liked, you know, a lot of the talks about actually looking at some of our, you know, methods and are they actually as accurate as they originally said they were in their actual studies? You know, there was a really awesome poster on yesterday about using the registration, and you know, the original engagement was like 80% accuracy or even higher, and then the student tested it was like, well, you know, it's kind of very machine closure, like 50-something%. And I'm like, okay, you know, let's think about why, and you know, using different technologies to assess things, you know, I don't know. But yeah, just, and that makes me excited for next year as well. I think just getting back to basics about, you know, what our field is about and methods and stuff. Yeah. And like the biological profile and, you know,
So from my side, it's more about, as we discussed, the diversity. And that's the multi, let's say, approach, multidisciplinary approach that we have in the AFS. And then we can jump from another perspective and to see other things and see other sciences, what they are doing. I think that's the highlight. There was not one specific thing. And here's two things to highlight what happened during, let's say, the tabs. Is that the simplicity that was done, the technology from one side, all the summaries, all the ways of explanation. And at the same time, there is other talks that was too simple to make believe. And I think that's the tricky part. That it's too easy to work with the machine learning or the LLM and so on. So it's not that easy. I think you know well. It's but not. The way that was presented, it was like, you do this and you have this. You do this and you have this. Too simple. You know? And that's the contrast that you have. From one side, it's simple for someone to understand how complex it is. And from the other, it's too simple to be used. But at the end, there is a question mark behind.
No, I don't get that. No one wants the conference necessarily to last too long because we're all exhausted by the end of the day. But sometimes I'm like, can this have been like 30-minute talk? Not 50.
Right.
But I just need like just a little more detail, please.
Yeah. I think that's so true though. Just, you know, everyone has to rush and then you're like, oh, look, no time for questions, and then people run off and like, okay, I guess I'll try and find this person or maybe just question. But yeah, no. It's always the hardest thing. It's like, so everything's captured for the next 2 days, Thursday and Friday. So this year, anthropology only had posters about Thursday and Friday. So just trying to like cram everything in here, like overwhelmed, trying to like do everything.
So I have these mental notes of, oh, I'm going to read that paper.
Download
it. I'm going to make sure to see
my pages that are just the person. I'm like, I'll find it.
My favorite is you'll see them up there and they'll use a software package and they'll do something with it and like, I tried that and can't get it to do squat. What extra thing are you doing?
Yeah.
And again, I think that's, I'll take it back on my soapbox. That's one of the big issues I have and why we organized our symposium focused on methodology and making the methodology accessible and understandable.
Yeah.
I think it is completely inadequate to say, I plugged some things into this program, some stuff happened, and then I had a result. Or even if you do that to the level of interacting with your computer scientists that way, where, oh, I just gave the stuff to the computer scientists, they did their thing to it, and boom, I have a program. Like, I think we do have to critically evaluate how we interact with that data and how we apply these tools, and then actually have to say how we do it.
Yeah.
That was not my favorite part of the conference, but those are my big opinions.
No, I mean, that also just like, I think probably most of us here got into forensic science, really probably watched a lot of crime shows growing up. You're like, 24 hours and I got an answer to everything. And I think sometimes these conferences make me be like, no way you could do that 15 minutes. Like,
yeah.
You cannot, no way you can explain AI technology to me, who I could barely get my computer to use Word document in 15 minutes. I'm sorry, you can't. I need more time. Sorry, go ahead.
I guess from the professor experience, like professor perspective, just as a general conference theme, like talking about AI would be really important because it gives accessible research to different students who have different needs in different places that don't have what you might think you're going to have in every program. Was I have a huge storehouse of skeletons back there, and so and that's just not the reality of most programs for students now. And so something that, you know, you can tear out like metadata from and look at it in a different way and use different technologies to do that is increasingly important from the perspective of having graduate students and undergraduates who want to get in this field, and then there's limitations in many ways for them. And so I think that that's can be important for students to see. For all you students out there.
I mean, I did my thesis using entirely open access data. I did not generate novel data
And I think that's increasingly important for us.
Yeah.
Like, there's a discussion where should we be digging things up and storing them and maybe using them sometimes?
My opinion is yes. Can we please
I mean, I love
the data.
Yeah, there's so much data. There's so much.
Like,
please
again,
use it.
Not to belittle that there is a complexity in how we distribute and interact with human remains research data. But I've said this a lot. The biomedical field does it. They do human remains research. They do living humans research. Can we do something that they do in us? Like, we don't have to just make it up from scratch.
I mean, starting to make us go through proper IRB protocols would be a great first step.
That would be good.
For those of you who don't know, any anthropologist or researcher who is doing a research study with humans or human remains has to apply for ethics approval through their university. And when you are using deceased remains, they are automatically not considered human individuals and therefore
not
research. Considered research. So that would be a huge first step, is not just waving our hands away at things like IRBs, but actually going through the process to ensure that we are doing ethical.
And for those that don't know, IRB is Institutional Review Board.
Or if you're in Canada, Research Ethics Board.
There you go.
And I had to go through one.
Yeah, I did too, but only because I'm using living samples.
You should do it anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even if you're using dead samples.
Yes,
by
absolutely.
The way.
Even if
it's
they
very,
just reject you.
Yes, it's a very important process that you should be
yes.
aware of.
Yeah.
You should know
ask
what the questions are. Yeah. And other people should be reviewing your work before you do it. So
yeah.
that's
and,
very important.
But it is an area where in different jurisdictions, different rules apply.
Yes.
In Canada, you have to file an REB if you're using deceased humans. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
I mean, that kind of plays into something that Taylor and Thomas brought up earlier about the disclaimers that we started seeing in the first slide of presentations, which seem newish, but not standardized and not for every presentation. But they didn't include there's human remains, or hey, I'm not including images of human remains because it's not necessary for what I'm talking about. Or I even mentioned, you know, land acknowledgments before we discuss things like that are becoming more standard in other fields and other fields of biological anthropology. And it was very clear that that's not standardized.
Yeah, here. For those of you who aren't here, there were many presentations this year that started with some sort of statement that says these are my opinions and not the opinions of my employer or my funder or whoever it is. And
well, the academy specifically, that's
yes.
the, that's that the academy required.
We have
did
no
they?
Financial.
Yeah.
Some of us were like, I didn't know that.
Wait,
yeah.
they required it?
Yeah,
they required it.
There
was
a
statement, and the moderators had to check that every presentation had that.
No
one. Oh, I did
that.
It
was in
that.
One of the many, many emails that came out, and it was in quotes. You have to have this exact wording
okay.
on your slide. You also have to
wow.
have a financial disclosure that says, do you have anything, any commercial financial disclosure?
I did.
Wow.
Not
and I think
that.
I think,
I think
my,
that is
I
an
think,
interesting decision
interesting.
For the Academy to make, particularly in our political climate.
And I think it was
people,
because of
yes.
the political climate.
Yeah.
Because, well, we only have 5 minutes. Because of the current political climate and the fact that the Academy does receive federal grants, they do not want the administration. They're trying their best not to have the administration come down hard. And it literally can come down to our section. We're all in the anthropology section, or most of us are in the anthropology section. The anthropology section has diversity admissions. That may get hurt because the Academy may have to say, you can't have that. It'll hurt us on a grander scale. So,
on that note, this podcast does not reflect the...
make sure
this podcast reflects our views and our views only, not those of our employers, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, or anybody else under the sun.
Thank you.
And on that note,
yeah, I think we've talked a good bit, and if anything we've talked about today really resonated with you and you want us to go into more detail, we can have further podcast about it. We try not to, you know, make this podcast too long. Maybe just, you know, you can listen to it on your ride home from work or school or whatever. But if you find anything you found really interesting and want us to talk about more, we can always pick some of our little guests here. I don't know why I said
little guests.
Give me a prize to Skylar.
Our fabulous guests.
Yes, thank you.
Largely fabulous. Randy.
Gigantic.
To come back and talk with us a little bit more about any of the topics, or we might even get some of them to come and talk about their research in particular. So thanks for hanging out with us. Probably see you hopefully sooner, but
we'll see you next month. And with that, good evening to all. We'll have, you know, the normal emails and everything up there for you all.
Thanks for joining the Bone Club.
Like, comment, and surprise.
Follow the podcast.
Bye to all. Bye to all. Oh, and we apologize. Jenna could not make it this year. She couldn't make it to AFS. She had a personal commitment this evening, and our thoughts and prayers are with her as she's dealing with that. Thank you.
I wave to myself.